Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls until we ask for them, because we have on the line a Mr. Robert Dreyfuss, and I've been looking forward to interviewing him for some time on his book called The Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Mr. Dreyfuss, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be on your show.
All right, fine. Now, of course, you've actually written for the Rolling Stones, and you've written for a lot of liberal magazines, but it really doesn't matter, liberal or conservative. The important thing is getting the truth out about what's going on here in the United States and the origins of our so-called war on terror. How did you happen to write this book?
Well, you know, after 9/11, it was like the United States suddenly collectively discovered that there was this force out there called the Islamic right, or conservative, or fundamentalist Islam, or political Islam, whatever you want to call it. And of course, the most extreme expression of that was Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's ideological allies. But really, it's a whole spectrum of elements within the Islamic world who have spent many decades organizing themselves, and I don't see it, of course, as an issue of the religion called Islam. Just like I wouldn't consider people who bomb abortion clinics or Irish Catholic bombers in Ireland to be representatives of Christianity. The religion of Islam is completely separate from what I call political Islam. And what I was thinking about after 9/11 was how, if you go back in history to the beginning of America's presence in the Middle East after World War II, you find out that consistently over those years, there was a tendency within the United States political circles and foreign policy elite to look at the conservative Islamic groups as allies, in part because they were anti-communist, or at least that was the theory, and in part because they were anti-nationalist. That is, they opposed some of the independent leaders that were emerging as the colonial powers retreated in that part of the world. I'm thinking of people like President Nasser in Egypt, or Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran. And in each of these cases, and in many others, the groups like the Muslim Brotherhood or conservative Islamic groups were seen as allies, as people that we could work with. And of course, it ended up backfiring.
And I think that's really what I learned from your book, is that this movement has been around for a long time, a lot longer than I really realized it. And, of course, it had ties into British intelligence, and then it had ties into American intelligence and into the CIA. And the incredible thing is that we financed so much of this radical Islamic movement. But there's so much more to tell. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Mr. Robert Dreyfuss. So you'll find this a fascinating story, The Devil's Game, because it really is the devil's game, and I think we've helped to finance the devil. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Mr. Robert Dreyfuss. His book is entitled The Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And I think the book is sort of characterized by a quotation here. I've never heard it before, but it came from General Nasser, who ruled Egypt for, the early 1950s until 1970 when he died. But this is what he wrote. "The genius of you Americans is that you never make clear-cut stupid moves. Only complicated, stupid moves, which make us wonder at the possibility that there may be something we're missing." Let me read that again. The genius of you Americans is that you never make clear-cut, stupid moves, only complicated, stupid moves, which make us wonder at the possibility that there may be something we are missing. I thought that was the most amazing statement. I think that there are a lot of people out there who wonder sometimes what American foreign policy is really all about.
Well, you know, That's one of my favorite quotes from the world of politics, and it came to mind as I was doing this book when I thought about Iraq, because someone once said invading Iraq after 9/11 was like if Franklin Roosevelt had decided to invade Mexico after Pearl Harbor.
I think that's a beautiful analogy.
And of course, not only was now of course Saddam Hussein was not exactly Santa Claus, but I think we now know that he had nothing to do with 9/11. Yet, by going into Iraq, and especially in the way that we did, we have ended up creating the foundations of a theocracy there. The ruling parties are two Shiite religious parties closely tied to Iran that have powerful militias which terrorize not only the non-Shiite population of Iraq, but also the secular Shias and the less religious Shias in Iraq who have no use for these religious parties but are now being controlled and dominated by them. So here's a situation where the United States goes into Iraq and ends up now with our troops as the kind of Praetorian guard for a Shiite religious theocracy that's taking place. And I think that's almost the perfect coda or conclusion to my book, that here we are once again, seemingly on purpose, creating or supporting a...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was simply talking to Mr. Robert Dreyfuss, who has written a book entitled The Devil's Game, and I'd quoted a wonderful, wonderful quotation he has in his book, which certainly is one of the most important things I got out of this book, and I really, in fact, I've included it in my latest newsletter, and this is what General Nasser, who ruled Egypt for pretty close to 18 years, said, 17 or 18 years. "The genius of you Americans is that you never make clear-cut stupid moves. You only complicated stupid moves which make us wonder at the possibility that there may be something we're missing." And Mr. Dreyfuss says this is sort of like what's happened in Iraq. We go into Iraq because Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction that threaten us, and then we don't find any weapons of mass destruction, and we unleash, of course, this whole terrible civil war, and we're on the verge of a civil war there. There's no way out of this situation. The president is determined to stay there, which is only going to prolong the suffering. If we pull out, there's chaos. If we stay there, there's chaos. How could you do something this stupid unintentionally?
Yeah, that's a really good question. But then what I tried to do in my book is show that we've done some fairly stupid things, especially in the Middle East, over many, many years, going back to at least the 1940s. And that, by the way, includes what I would consider to be almost a fundamental mistake, which is instead of supporting those in the Arab world, let's say, who wanted to free themselves from colonialism and who wanted to build independent, non-aligned states, we ended up supporting Saudi Arabia, which used conservative Islam as the arm of its foreign policy and which created conservative Islamic opposition forces in almost all of those Arab countries.
And of course, really, by supporting the Saudis, why we got the animosity of anybody who wanted to be free, because this is a feudal dictatorship that oppresses women and cuts off people's hands and feet and their heads, and yet we're not concerned about that. We're concerned about how wicked Saddam Hussein is, and he was a very wicked man and still is. But we seem to be very selective in our morality. Have you had that feeling?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, it's clear that during the Cold War, we justified a lot of things on the basis of anything goes in the fight against communism. And, you know, we know by now, it's pretty clear, we supported a lot of dictators around the world, from Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines to the generals in Brazil and so forth. But in the Middle East, a lot of the leaders that emerged at that time in the 50s and the 60s were not anywhere as brutal as Saddam Hussein. But the reason they could not get support from the United States is because our approach to that part of the world at the time was, if you're not willing to join NATO or some American-sponsored alliance, and there were a whole series of them, CENTO and CETO and the Baghdad Pact and so forth. If you're not willing to join these alliances or choose sides in the Cold War, then we're against you. And of course, a lot of these leaders, they were not communists. I mean, they were far from communism. In fact, they didn't like the Soviet Union. But because they wouldn't choose sides and wanted to remain non-aligned or independent, they were considered suspect. So the Islamic groups emerged as militant opponents, not only of communism, but of these nationalist groups. And I think that got us off on the wrong foot in the region, you know, almost from the get-go.
And I think you put it. Hello there. Hello, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Oh. Someone was beeping.
All right, fine. Well, we'll have to find out what that is. Anyway, I think that the significant thing I learned from you is that basically there were various forces at work in the Middle East. One of them was a communist. Now, we were anti-communist, so anybody who was anti-communist, we embraced. And, of course, the Islamists were really sort of almost fascist in many respects. I mean, they really wanted this this world Islamic movement, and, of course, we know that many of these people had been affiliated with the Nazis during the Second World War, and that we saw nothing wrong with embracing them because they were anti-communist. And it really didn't make much sense because they were just as oppressive of the people as the communists were.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and some of these individuals, you know, were later picked up by the CIA and became agents of the CIA operating on our behalf, or we hired them to do propaganda or radio broadcasts. And not only that, by the way, but it wasn't just that they were seen as anti-communists within their own countries, but starting in the 1950s, there were many people who began to search for ways of destabilizing the Soviet Union itself, and they looked at Central Asia, which was then part of the USSR, and they said, well, look, there are 50 million Muslims there, and if we could just rile them up, if we could just poke a stick into that hornet's nest, then that would cause problems at home for the Kremlin, for the communists. And there was a school of foreign policy strategists that became quite powerful in the 1970s. That argued that that's exactly what the United States should begin to do, and we began to beef up radio broadcasts into that part of the world. And the ultimate culmination of this was the jihad in Afghanistan, where it wasn't just seen as a way of fighting the Soviet Union in that little landlocked country, but of reaching north across the border and to stirring up Islamic groups in countries that are now independent, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and so forth. People can look those up on a map and see how they're kind of stretched out across the middle of Asia. Well, all of those republics now are fighting militant, even terrorist Islamic groups, many of which got their start, if not with direct American support, then with indirect support from Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia.
Both of which we were supporting, of course.
Absolutely. And one of the ironies that, you know, people know that we fought an 8-year war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, in which we collected militant Arab suicide bombers and all kinds of other radicals and shipped them off to Afghanistan to fight the USSR there. What they don't know, at least in most cases, is that the United States, even earlier in the 1970s, was involved with some of these same Islamic radicals in Afghanistan to try to draw the Soviet Union into Afghanistan. And that's what Dr. Brzezinski, who was President Carter's national security advisor, said in just those words, that we're trying to provoke the Soviets to invade Afghanistan so we can tie them down and fight a war against them.
And, of course, it was going to be a long, bloody war that would have a tremendous impact upon the Soviet the spirit. It would begin to bankrupt the Soviet Union, exactly like our current war in Iraq is doing to the United States today.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the analogy between the Soviets in Afghanistan and what is going on in Iraq today is really rather striking, don't you think? Like, maybe what goes around comes around?
Well, I think it's a good analogy. And, of course, at the time, the Soviets looked at Afghanistan and compared it to what happened in Vietnam to the United States. So maybe the lesson of this is that big powers aren't too well suited for fighting guerrilla wars in small but fiercely independent third world countries. I don't know. I do know that partly as a result of all of the aid and succor that we gave to these groups over the years, we're now seeing the rise of organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and in Syria and in Jordan and in Kuwait, in Palestine among the Palestinians. The terrorist group Hamas is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, there's a potential for these groups, if not to take over these societies, because we don't know how strong they are, to at least cause enormous political damage to societies as democracy begins to develop in those countries. So the idea that I think that President Bush has, that we can go in and simply create democracy by at the stroke of a pen, by going in and telling them that we want them to hold elections and so forth, is very, very dangerous, because if these countries aren't ready for democracy, and Syria is the perfect example. I have a story out in the current issue of the American Conservative that talks about Syria. President Assad, another, bad guy, I mean, someone who is not exactly a leader from, the Salvation Army, is nonetheless the power in Syria. And if he were to disappear, it's very likely that the Muslim Brotherhood would establish another theocracy in that country.
And I think that's really so important. I've heard that the Israelis are frightened to death. That if we go into Syria and topple that government, or we use our CIA to topple Assad's government, that it will totally destabilize it. And as bad as Assad is, the Muslim Brotherhood would be worse. And what we're doing really is recruiting as many people as we can into the Islamic, into the Muslim Brotherhood. And they really weren't that popular before we invaded Iraq. And I believe what we've done, is actually recruit people all throughout the Islamic world for the Muslim Brotherhood. Would you agree to that?
Yes, I would very much agree to that. In fact, I think by going into Iraq, we've handed Osama bin Laden his cherished, dreamed-for recruiting tool.
And
now he can preach to all of his followers and would-be followers that, look, they just want our oil. The United States is a threat to the Islamic world. And a lot of his recruits are coming out of that argument.
Hold up. We'll be right back in just a moment. Another of our
fascinating four tape sets is entitled Concentration Camps, and it's four interviews with people talking about the move to establish concentration camps in the United States. Now, most people say that's foolish talk. We couldn't have that. And yet, if you listen to these tapes, you'll find out that those camps are a reality. They are being set up in case of civil disturbance. And, of course, the authority for the establishment of the concentration camps comes from the executive orders, which were actually put through during the time of the Reagan administration. For documentation of the location and the background to the formation of these camps, their establishment, and what may very well happen or what they may be used for in the future, I suggest you call our 800 number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for America, our values, our future are under attack today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox. The fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine. But those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like a corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. Robert Dreyfuss. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Game, which we are going to carry because we think it's an important book. Why? Because it goes into the background of this whole Islamic movement and really takes it back into the 1860s with a fellow named Afghani. And he really wasn't an Afghan at all. He was a Persian, but he was trying to create the impression that he was an Arab and that he was a dedicated follower of Allah. And all the evidence shows he didn't even believe in Allah. He was a Freemason, and he was really working hand in glove with the British intelligence. Would you like to tell the story of Afghani? Because this is a fascinating story. And here we see the Freemasonic influence, we see the British intelligence influence, and we see a man who begins this whole idea of a worldwide caliphate under Islam who doesn't even believe in Allah.
Yeah, Afghani, as you mentioned, described himself as an Afghan, in part because as a Persian and therefore as someone who was considered or would have been considered a Shiite, he would have been seen as a minority. But he developed a theory about the usefulness of religion. In other words, if you're trying to achieve power or control or other kinds of gains, what use can religion play? And he spent most of his active life in the 1870s and 80s traveling around the region trying to create a whole series of secret societies based around the idea of reviving Islam as a worldwide effort, and reaching back into the early days of Islam at a time when most people, by the way, were not thinking like that at all.
And the average Muslim wasn't interested in this radical form of Islam, was he?
No, he. You know, we now know from his writings and letters and so forth that he scoffed at religious people, and he considered himself to have kind of a secret knowledge that was above and beyond the knowledge of religious people. And time again, he offered his services to the British, you know, who were fighting that so-called great game at the time, the British versus the Tsar of Russia for control of Asia and India and the Middle East. And he offered his services mostly to the British, but also at one point to the Russians, and became sort of a British agent. You mentioned that he was a Freemason, not in the sense that a lot of Americans today belong to some, you know, Freemason group and they see it as kind of just a fun social event, but at that time, his Freemasonry groups were kind of underground secret societies that built memberships in places like Cairo and Damascus and into Europe, and which became the forerunner of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's really Afghani's significance, is that he and his followers created not only the idea of pan-Islam, but the theoretical basis that was later picked up by the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1920s. And it's the same Muslim Brotherhood that exists today in virtually every country in the Islamic world. So Afghani was kind of the founder of that worldwide effort.
And it was about two generations later when the Muslim Brotherhood comes along, but it's also getting funding from American intelligence, isn't it?
Well, first, of course, from the British. The United States didn't really come into the Middle East until the 1940s, after
right.
World War II. Before that, the Muslim Brotherhood played a game with the British and with the King of Egypt and so forth, against some of those same nationalist parties that we talked about before. Then when the United States came into the region, we started to see these Muslim Brotherhood types as possible allies. And in my research, I came across a fascinating photograph of a man named Saeed Ramadan. And, hello?
Right, we're here just listening. Go ahead.
Yes, Saeed Ramadan, he was the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I found a photograph of Ramadan meeting in the Oval Office with President Eisenhower. That really was shocking to me, and it led me on a whole investigation, because here's a man who came out of a group, the Muslim Brotherhood, that had committed violent terrorist acts, had assassinated an Egyptian prime minister, and yet he ends up meeting in the Oval Office with the President. So I started to ask myself, why? How did he get there? And what happened to him afterwards? And what we find out, and what we now know from other research that's been done besides mine by a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who went into the German archives, that a lot of these groups that were recruited by the CIA in the Cold War included Ramadan.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back.
if there's any one tape that you should hear, it's my talk on geopolitics, an untold story that is vitally important if America is to survive as a free nation. It goes into the background of the forces that have created the wars of the 20th century, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam. We go into the ideological and the spiritual battle behind the forces that have moved America from crisis to crisis and are currently undermining the very fabric of our society. That number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and the tape, Geopolitics. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of my talk on geopolitics.
Sophisticated investors are buying gold and silver today because the dollar has lost almost 50% of its value in relationship to the euro, and the price of gold and silver has increased almost 40%. If you're interested in learning more about precious metal investing, why don't you call Bo at 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177, or visit him at Elliott's Stamp and Coin Shop in downtown Santa Cruz at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building, which is located between Trader Joe's and the Signature Twin Movie Theater. Bo's telephone number is 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177. And he's located at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building. And if you mention you heard about Elliott Stamp and Coin Shop on Radio Liberty, why, you'll get a 15% discount on some non-investment items.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Robert Dreyfus, and we're talking about his book, The Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And, of course, you go back, and the Muslim Brotherhood was officially created in 1928. Now, the idea had been around going back two generations to this fellow named Afghani. But then, of course, we have the Brotherhood created in 1928, and then the son-in-law of the man who created that is a fellow named Ramadan, and he's meeting with President Roosevelt. What was that, about 1940?
President Eisenhower.
Eisenhower, okay.
In the early 1950s.
Okay, fine.
Yes, and Saeed Ramadan was involved in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt from 1940 when he was a teenager. Until he married the founder's daughter, and he became kind of its international organizer. And when President Nasser took over Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood clashed bitterly with Nasser and eventually tried to kill him. There was an assassination attempt, and the Brotherhood was banned and repressed. And Ramadan fled the country, first to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and Jordan, and he set up organizations all along the way to reflect the kind of ideological conviction that these radical Muslim Brotherhood activists had. And he finally settled in Geneva, Switzerland. And we now know from archives work that's been done in both Switzerland as well as in Germany that Ramadan had been picked up or recruited by the CIA to be used against Soviet or communist influence in the Middle East sometime in the late 1950s and possibly earlier. In other words, possibly as early as his meeting with President Eisenhower in 1953. At the very least, I think he was spotted then. And he turns up in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, in every major outbreak of the Islamist movement, whether it was the Afghan Jihad or the Iranian Revolution in the late 1970s, or whether it was the upsurges of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the 1960s, he continually turns up as a key player from something called the Islamic Center in Geneva, which still exists, and it's run by his equally militant son now, Hani Ramadan. Ramadan had the support of Saudi Arabia, but not just of the country of Saudi Arabia, which, as people know, perhaps, the princes that run Saudi Arabia are not particularly religious, most of them. They're playboys that have houses and yachts in the south of France and so forth. But the conservative wing in Saudi Arabia, which supports the Wahhabi movement and the ultra-religious forces there, well, they supported Ramadan. He, in turn, help them organize Islamic groups all over the Middle East. The Saudis financed his center in Geneva, and then he helped them organize two important organizations. The first one was the Muslim World League, and then the second, that was in 1962, and then later in 1969, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is kind of a mini United Nations for the Islamic world, but both under strong Saudi Arabian influence. And those two organizations became, I would say, the two most important organizations for the spread of the Islamist philosophy. And again here I'm using Islamist as distinct from Islam, because obviously there are hundreds of millions of Muslims all over this part of the world, many of whom do not subscribe to the kind of radical ideas that the Muslim Brotherhood put forward. But the Islamists, with Saudi backing, have been building up and organizing momentum ever since the end of World War II, at least, and are the ideological forebears of bin Laden's organization, Al-Qaeda. It was one of Saeed Ramadan's co-thinkers, a man named Sayyid Qutb, who lived in Egypt in the 1960s, who wrote the very ideological tracts that became the basis for the ideas of Al-Qaeda, of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and other radical organizations that kind of branched out of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, one of the most significant things I learned from your book is about Islamic banking. And I think this is really such an important issue, and I would like to spend a few minutes on that. Because, of course, we see the hand of American intelligence and our intelligence agencies working behind the scenes, encouraging this movement at every turn. And then, of course, we see the rise of Islamic banking. And, of course, banking is so key to what's going on in the world today. And suddenly you have a whole separate banking system, although it's interlocking with Citibank and Chase Manhattan Bank. But these are some of the wealthiest banks in the world, aren't they?
Yeah, this Islamic banking notion, though it had some experimental versions a little bit earlier, really took off after 1973. And some of your older listeners will remember that that was the year that OPEC quintupled the price of oil and caused the first oil crisis going into 1974. And as a result, a huge amount of money, petrodollars, began to flow into Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the other countries in the Gulf in particular, which had these huge surpluses. Well, enormous numbers of banks began to arise to use these petrodollars. And some of them were just like any other bank. They were run by wealthy individuals who wanted to make money. But an important chunk of those banks, a minority chunk, but a significant one, were Islamic banks who developed a banking theory on the idea that Islam forbids interest. And, of course, most of the banks that do business in the Middle East don't bother with that. They found ways to around that in the modern world. But these Islamic banks began to spring up first in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt. And then as they spread into Turkey and Kuwait and Sudan, usually with the help of Western banks that provided technology and advice and, you know, help in sort of knowing how to run a bank, well, they began the financiers of Islamist radicals who, you know, would be able to go to these banks and get money to start Islamist businesses, media companies, publishing empires, radio broadcasts, and even organizational support. So these banks became critical for the growth in the 1970s, after this big oil shock, of the early Islamist movement at that time.
And, of course, you know, the one thing is that President Bush had said, you know, that we're going to go after the people who are financing the Islamic movement. Well, a lot of it was being financed through these Islamic banks. Have they done anything about the Islamic banks and their funding of terrorism?
Well, you know, you have to be very careful about that because we can't, you know, with a belief in civil liberties and civil rights, go around criminalizing people's political beliefs, no matter how stupid they may seem or how, you know, out of the mainstream. It's one thing to have Islamist political beliefs. It's another thing to support terrorism. So it's difficult, I think, to crack down on people who don't engage overtly in terrorism, but who have radical political beliefs.
But, of course, if you're financing terrorism, well, that puts you, at least according to President Bush, that puts you in their category. And yet I don't think we're really trying to cut off the funds. At least this is my impression.
Well, I think there have been a number of steps taken since 9/11 to crack down on some of the terrorist money flow. And many, many organizations have been banned or had their assets seized or have been shut out of the United States and so forth. Now, sure, we could be doing more, but it's a very difficult an analysis to try to track some of these money flows and know, you know, what's going to terrorism and what's going to simply, you know, ideological Islamist views. It would be the same, let's say, if you were trying to track money to the crazies who bomb abortion clinics here, and then say, well, how much of their, you know, banks or supporters or whatever are connected to maybe Christian charities? Well, you know, that's we certainly don't want in the United States to go down that road, because people have the right to have views from the far left to the far right here without having their finances inspected. So I think it's the same overseas, but I think my point is that because these banks believed in free market principles, because they believed in you know, the profit motive, they often were treated by banks and others as you know, happy partners, and therefore they were able to spread their power into places like Kuwait. And I trace in my book how the Kuwaiti royal family several decades ago used or organized some of these Islamist banks to fight against the nationalists in Kuwait, who wanted to get rid of that the kleptocracy of that royal family that runs that corner of the Persian Gulf. And so the royal family reached out to these Islamists. They set up a bank called the Kuwait Finance House, and it in turn financed the growth of Islamists all over Kuwait, which then, as you correctly point out, some of those became terrorists. Some of those became people who bombed the American embassy or conducted other kinds of terrorism in Kuwait. The majority probably didn't go into terrorism. But when you talk about fighting the war on terrorism, I guess I contend in my book it's not something that you can fight too intelligently with the military. You need to fight it by eliminating the motive for angry or bitter young people into terrorist groups in the first place.
Don't you think the fact that we are occupying Iraq today, and the average, average Arab or average Muslims look upon us as the occupier, and that is really what's fomenting this whole thing, and that's why we have ever increasing numbers of terrorist attacks on our troops, and instead of addressing the issue, we seem to think that if we just stay there with enough troops and we kill enough people, this is all going to come to an end.
Oh, that's right. And I recommend in my book that we need to lower the political temperature in the region. I compare this to a pot of water on the stove, that if you raise the heat and it starts to boil, sure, most of the water stays in the pot, but some of those steam escapes out into the atmosphere. Well, if you think of the Middle East like that, if you boil the Middle East, then the steam that escapes are the radicals, and they get sucked up by these terrorist groups. So if you want to eliminate terrorism, or at least vastly reduce it, I think we'll always have some, then you lower the temperature so that the water's not boiling. And how do you do that? Certainly by beginning to withdraw our forces from Iraq as soon as possible, but also reducing our presence in the region. We don't need so many troops and military bases in places like Kuwait and Bahrain and Qatar, these sheikdoms in the Persian Gulf.
But of course we're building them frantically as if we're planning on staying there forever, and that is the perception that the Muslims have. And that is this perception that the people who are joining the radical Islam have, is that we're there and we're not going to leave.
Yeah, and you know, that's because some of the neoconservatives, particularly in the Bush administration, see the world as a big chessboard, and so the Middle East is really the heart of that chess game, and they see the United States competing with China, and therefore we've got to control the Middle East and the oil before China does, and that kind of thinking plays right into the hands of the terrorists. And at the same time that we reduce our presence there, I hope we would also start to look seriously at a real serious effort to bring about a settlement of the Israel-Palestine problem. It's been festering for so many years now, and it really is an ideological thorn or spear in the side of the region that has created a lot of anger and bitterness. And I'm not talking about eliminating Israel, of course. I'm talking about an Israeli deal with the Palestinians on carving up that part of the world's real estate in a way that both sides are satisfied. And then once you do that, I think you will see that another big bunch of the steam is let out of this balloon, and people will start to relax. And you know, the same approach has to be taken in other areas, whether it's Chechnya or Kashmir or Sudan, where there are Islam versus non-Islam conflicts. And the more these kinds of disputes can be resolved peacefully, then I think you remove some of the anger and bitterness that fuels these terrorist movements. It's a problem that didn't get created in just the last couple of years. It's been festering for a long time, and I'm the first one to say it's going to take many years to solve it.
Well, my fear is if we were to have a free and open election in Pakistan today, the Islamists would take over. If we were to have a free and open election in Egypt, the Islamists would take it over. They already hold almost the entire parliament in Turkey, and the only reason, of course, you do not have an Islamist state is because you have a military dictatorship, which we're keeping in power. But I look over there as a festering sore, and I don't. I wish I was as optimistic as you are. My fear is that we're going to eventually end up attacking Syria and Iran because the neoconservatives have a different vision of the world. They want to force democracy on on the whole of the Middle East and the rest of the world, and I'm not sure that the Middle East is ready for democracy. Are you?
Well, I'm not sure I'm any less pessimistic than you, except, I would say, that because Iraq was the first major neoconservative initiative, and it's gone so badly wrong, I think that the neoconservatives in Washington have lost some of their influence. Certainly, Dick Cheney and his staff are still very powerful. But I think that throughout even the Bush administration, there are many people who are beginning to say, wait a minute, you got us into this mess in Iraq. Why should we listen to you about Iran or Syria or other things? So I think it would take some doing for them to have the kind of power that they had 4 years ago, let's say.
We're out of time, but I would want to get you back on other programs. Thank you so much for being with us. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. And I should mention my website if people want to know any more about my articles or my book or anything. It's just
drcrisis.com,
and people can go there and email me and send comments. And
now what is the website one more time?
It's just my name, Robert Dreyfus. .com, and it's DREYFUSS.
All right, RobertDreyfus.com, and actually we're gonna carry a book. I think it's a very, very important book, and I really appreciate so very much you're taking the time to be with us, and of course you're writing the book. It's vitally important the American people begin to understand the background of how we got into this mess. And
thanks very much. I thought your questions were extremely well thought out, and it's a pleasure to do an interview like that.
Well, I, of course, was so fascinated with your book that I read the book through from cover to cover, and I'll probably read it through again. God bless, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Tape set, Genocide. And one of the tapes is an interview with a Dr. Dinigan who heard back in 1969 actually a talk given by Dr. Day, who would later become the president of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Day laid out the whole plan for America. The fact there are too many people, the fact that we're going to have to create new diseases, the fact that we're going to have to conceal some of the very obvious treatments.
You know, when I was growing up,
people are going to have to die of something. They might as well tie up cancer. An incredible interview and a series of other interviews that will go into the background of what is happening in America, why new diseases are cropping up all the time. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of our 4-tape set, Genocide. It's vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. America, our values, our future are under attack today.
Oh, when I was growing up, my parents weren't worried about our education. We were taught the basics of math and English, science and history, the joy of art and music, and the need for sports. And our generation turned out leaders in every field. But as a parent today, I am concerned with my child's education. That's why I chose VHM Christian School. I know that at VHM, my children are getting a quality education with a biblical foundation. I'm not worried whether they'll be prepared. I know they are. VHM gives my children the tools to succeed and instills moral values. There are so many issues for me to be concerned about. I'm glad my children's education is not one of them. Won't you call VHM today? Your child is worth it. Call 475-4762. That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Mr. Robert Dreyfus, DREYFUSS, and of his book, The Devil's Game. We will be offering that through my ministry. We think it's an important book to give you the historical background of what's going on there. Now, it is my contention that the people within the Project for the New American Century, certainly we call them neoconservatives, but they're not conservatives at all. They're old-line fascists, Trotskyites, who are dedicated to creating a one-world dictatorship. And under, of course, the control of intellectuals like them, and behind that are powerful spiritual forces. Now, if you have not yet seen my talk, Iraq, the Untold Story, you need to get the video, and then you need to get the syllabus that goes with that. It will give you the history of all of the wars of the last century, and it'll then take you right up through the current Iraqi war, and we'll give you the information that not what I say, that the Project for the New American Century says, but what they say from their website. You need to get it. You need to read the information. You need to understand that this war has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. This war was planned at least in 1998. I think it was probably planned many decades ago, maybe even as long as 50 to 100 years ago. But we certainly have their letters to President Kennedy, pardon me, to President Clinton, in 1998 calling for war with Iraq and with Saddam. In the year 2000, their call for a war with Iraq and Saddam. The attack on the World Trade Center was just a, well, was it a just an accident, or was it what they wanted? In fact, if you read their writings, and you'll get them from this syllabus, in their pamphlet called Rebuilding America's Defenses, they say quite openly, what we needed is another incident like another Pearl Harbor. Another incident like another Pearl Harbor. And you know, wasn't it just strange that on September 11th, the year 2001, we had an incident like another Pearl Harbor, and those terrorists were so smart, they scheduled their attack at the World Trade Center the same day the military was scheduling exercises, you know, pretending that a terrorist plane was going to be crashed into the Pentagon. And many of the air traffic controllers that morning were saying, is this a real attack, or is this part of the exercise? It was all planned long ahead of time. And the question is, how could those terrorists be so smart? There was hardly anybody on the planes. There were only about a quarter of the normal passenger load. And if you get on a plane with only a quarter of the normal passengers on it, you better start looking around for somebody wearing a turban. And ladies and gentlemen, there are too many things that happened on September 11th for it just to have been coincidence. And the one thing, of course, you only need to do is remember what happened to Building 7. Building 7 came down just like it had been imploded. There was no way that came down because it was a fire. They got the firemen out, and they told them the building's coming down, and, you know, the building came down. Do you think that really happened by accident? Do you think the magic passports happened by accident? We've got a great video. If you've never seen Dave Wegener's The Day of Deceit, you need to get it. And again, then we hope you'll call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You need to get our pamphlets, Foreknowledge 911, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3. They're only $10, $9.95 for all three of them. You need to get our three pamphlets on the occult hierarchy, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3. You need to get our pamphlet on We Are a Republic. You need to understand why President Bush keeps talking about why we want to bring democracy to Iraq. Why do we want to bring democracy to Iraq when the United States is a republic, not a democracy? Is there another agenda that you're not being told about? Well, we do hope that many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, that you'll certainly give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, perhaps join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and that you'll help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day and on regular programs. And now we're on Telstar 5. You can hear it, listen 9 hours a day, not get much of anything accomplished. If you'd like to know more about Telstar 5, if you'd like to get our MP3 files, they're now posted on our site for our afternoon and evening programs. And then pray for America, pray for Radio Liberty.